Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
There's no time to waste. We have to act, and we have to act now.
Learning the lessons from the last stimulus, Biden's economic rescue plan for America goes in big and fast. Nobel Prize-winning economist Paul Krugman shatters the deficit hype. Then, what's next for Trump's own bank balance and his future after he leaves office? I talk to his niece and author Mary Trump, as well as Andrea Bernstein, co-host of the hit podcast Trump Inc. Plus,
in America, there is a strand that is ugly, that is intolerant, that is racist, that is prone to violence if provoked, if stoked.
Our Walter Isaacson talks to former Secretary of Homeland Security Jay Johnson about cutting out the violence ahead of the inauguration. And finally, it is Martin Luther King Day. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. A new era of American politics begins this week with Joe Biden's inauguration, and he plans to hit the ground running from day one, getting control of the COVID pandemic and the economic havoc that it has wrought. Biden has introduced a $1.9 trillion spending package to speed up the distribution of vaccines and provide immediate financial relief to people. His plan focuses on bigger stimulus checks, aid to the unemployed and those who are facing eviction, as well as to additional help for small businesses, state and local governments. Despite the predictable conservative pushback over budget deficits, most major economic institutions say this is unlike any previous crisis. My first guest says now is the time to be big and bold. Paul Krugman is a Nobel Prize winning economist and author. He's joining me now from New York. Welcome back to the program, Paul Krugman. And I guess I just take it from one of your recent columns where you say about Biden, the advice is damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. Break that down for us.
Okay, so the important background is two things. One is that this ain't over, that the pandemic is going to continue to have a crippling effect on the economy, at least into the summer and maybe some ways into the fall. We're not going to, I'm just relying on the epidemiologists here, but we're not going to be able to resume business as usual until a large percentage of the population is vaccinated, which means that's going to take a long time. During that period, life is going to be very, very hard. Lots of jobs cannot come back until the virus is under control. And on the other side, money is not a constraint. U.S. government can borrow at incredibly low interest rates, well below the rate of inflation and even further below the growth rate of the economy, which is what really matters, so that there really is effectively no budget constraint. So this is a time to spend a lot of money on keeping people, keeping governments, keeping businesses whole until the pandemic is under control.
And it looks like President-elect is inclined to take that advice. We just said that he's unveiled this $1.9 trillion stimulus relief. I'm not sure exactly how you term it, but nonetheless, injection. And so many financial institutions are tending to agree with what you're saying. Just want to play what Biden himself says about the urgency of the moment.
And it's not hard to see that we're in the middle of the once-in-several-generations economic crisis, with a once-in-several-generations public health crisis. The crisis of deep human suffering is in plain sight, and there's no time to waste. We have to act, and we have to act now. This is what economists are telling us. More importantly, it's what the values we hold dear in our hearts as Americans are telling us.
So, Paul Krugman, you know, there is your advice, and then, as I said, there's pushback from conservatives, maybe other economists. Tell me, though, in general, where do most economists land on advice for the current calamity?
Oh, there's really not a lot of dissent from the view that something like what Biden is proposing is the right thing to do. I mean, you can always find somebody who's on the other side. Of course, you'll find that, you know, conservative, basically people who are operatives who are on the other side. But there's been a sea change in economic opinion about deficits. The truth is that the panic over deficits 10 years ago was much more in the political sphere than the economic sphere. Economists were always much more relaxed about them than you would have believed if you only listened to the talk shows. But even from there, now economists have learned a lot. The world has changed, but also we've learned that that a lot of the concerns that seem to be pressing to at least some of my colleagues are not. So there's really very little argument about the ability to go big. And the nature of the problem, the severity of it is really clear. It's, you know, we've learned a lot about the damage, the long-term damage that failing to provide short-term support can inflict. So this is really, in other words, you need to cushion people. You need to get people through this in the present, not just to make it easier in the present, but to avoid long-term damage in the future. If you can say, it's a little bit like, you know, the long-termers on COVID. If we don't do COVID economic relief, we'll get long-term economic damage as well as long-term health damage.
So you've obviously been remarkably consistent. Last time around, 2008, 2009, you criticized the Obama administration for actually being too cautious. And particularly, it appears that the bailout, as it was called then, was targeted towards the banks, towards the big infrastructure. This looks like it's different, right? This looks like it's not to, like, jumpstart massive economic growth immediately. It's more to resuscitate the economy and help ordinary people. Can you sort of break down the difference between what Biden is trying to do compared to what the Obama administration bailout was before?
Yeah, the last time around we had a financial crisis. The cause of the crisis was internal. The economy was overstretched. The private sector was overstretched. There was too much borrowing. Housing prices were unrealistic and they crashed. And that led to a lot of constraint. And so the problem with the economy was that there was not enough spending because of this economic breakdown. This time, although spending is down somewhat, it's down not because people can't spend, but because they don't dare to spend. Who's going to go to, well, some people will go to restaurants, but you really shouldn't, and we really want to constrain that. So the problem, but the economic suffering is very real. So this is very much not about trying to juice up the economy so much as it is about making the necessary shutdown, the necessary constraints. I don't know if we're still calling it a lockdown, but whatever. It's about making the difficult times less difficult, with there being essentially, again, no real constraints. The money is available. In fact, the world is awash in savings, looking for some place to go. The bond market is begging the government to borrow some money and put it to some use. So it's a very different kind of economic crisis, but the lesson that we should have learned, you know, that some of us were tearing our hair out about in 2009, remains. Go big. Don't do it by half measures. The risk of doing too little is much greater than the risk of doing too much. And above all, of course, don't count on being able to, you know, get a political consensus to do stuff later on. We've seen how that movie ends, and it doesn't end well. So, I mean, Biden came in with a bigger plan than most people had expected, and almost every economist I know was cheering.
You know, it's really so interesting for me as a layperson to hear you say that the world is awash in money, that the bond people are begging to, you know, to be able to use that money to some good. And I think that's just, people can understand that instead of thinking, oh my goodness, oh panic, we're going to go into massive debt, what's that going to mean, et cetera, et cetera. But you talk about politics, and so I want to ask you to react to this then, because Last time you said the politicians were way more negative than the economists were. And this time, Pat Toomey, who's a fiscal conservative from Pennsylvania, says in response to the $1.9 trillion, in less than 1 year, Congress has spent $3.4 trillion on direct COVID relief aid and nearly doubled the entire federal budget, blasting out another $2 trillion in borrowed or printed money. When the ink on December's $1 trillion aid bill is barely dry and much of the money is not yet spent, would be a colossal waste and economically harmful. So you're essentially saying he's incorrect on the merits, but what about the politics? Because doesn't a lot of this require Biden to get consensus and approval?
Well, that's the interesting thing. I mean, if that election, that runoff in Georgia was enormously important, it gave the Democrats by the narrowest possible margin control of the Senate, and they have a narrow margin in the House, and that allows them to do a lot of stuff. The filibuster can be bypassed for a lot of things, which Obama could have done also, but wasn't willing to because he didn't fully understand what he was facing politically. But Biden obviously does after all we've been through. So this can be done. I mean, obviously, the most conservative Democrats are needed. If Joe Manchin says no, then things don't happen. So it's going to be somewhat tailored. But I think there's a broad acceptance within the Democratic Party of the need to go big here. And the Republicans are going to do what they're going to do. Not only their political position, but their moral position is weakened because they, after screaming about deficits under Obama, they suddenly stopped caring under Trump. And it's really hard to turn the outrage back on as soon as a new president is installed. So, you know, people have in a way taken their measure, and it's not going to stop them from saying the usual things, but it is going to reduce the extent to which they're taken seriously.
So just remind why the deficits have ballooned under Trump.
Oh, well, Trump, even before the pandemic, the deficits were up, and basically partly it's actually a lot of it is the tax cut, the 2017 tax cut, big handout to corporations, to some extent to high income individuals. It was supposed to produce a giant surge in investment, which never happened. But also, in fact, the spending constraints. Federal spending was held in a vice grip as long as there was a Democrat in the White House. And as soon as it was a Republican, Republicans in Congress were willing to loosen that and extend the tap. So if you look at the Trump record, the big thing is the tax cut. But then there are also things like all of that extremely generous aid to farmers who were hurt by Trump's trade war. There was no sense that, we can't have big government handouts. If it's politically important people who vote Republican, then we're going to spend lots of money. So that just in general, it was a very, all of that claims that fiscal discipline was crucial went by the wayside as soon as Trump was in the White House. Mm-hmm. And I'm not complaining about that, right? It actually did no harm because debt is cheap.
Again, it's really important for us to focus on that because ordinary citizens like myself, we make a difference, I guess, between our own household expenses and what a government can and should do, which often are not exactly the same. Perhaps individuals prefer to save, not go into debt, but governments, and as you're laying out quite clearly, can and should in some circumstances. So the world is also saying things like this. The head of the IMF, Kristalina Georgieva, told me that this had to happen. The head of the ECB, the European Central Bank, and the OECD, all these big institutions are coming to this new orthodoxy. But particularly Georgieva told me how she would like to see the economy at the end of this tunnel. This is what she said.
We also need to think of this crisis as an opportunity, Christian. How can we boost the recovery in a way that it is green, it is climate resilient, in which we are thinking of gender equality, we make sure that women are treated as equal partners. In other words, can we, on the other side, have a better, stronger society than on this one?
So, Paul, I want to get your take on that. And I want to put up a little graphic that we have, because she talked about women. And in the United States, these latest job figures show that in December, the job losses were a total of 140,000, but the job losses by women, 156,000, whereas jobs gained by men, 16,000. So what is your take on what Georgieva said about where the spending should go?
Well, she's right. There's only so much of that you can do as part of a relief package. And if you look at what Biden has actually proposed, the main things there, most of it is stuff that is not really about shaping the economy post-pandemic. Most of it is about getting us through these next 7 or 8 months, which is unfortunately what you have to do. Now, there are pieces, unemployment benefits, maintaining enhanced unemployment benefits until the pandemic is gone. Since a lot of the people who lost jobs are in fact women, that's going to be something that matters. There's something I didn't expect, which is great, which is a big enhancement of child tax credits, which is a family thing. It's about children. That actually will, in the long run, pay for itself, because it'll mean more productive, healthier children who become better adults later on. But the big post-pandemic stuff is going to have to come a little bit later. We need a massive infrastructure spending. We need a lot of spending on children, on families, on women. And Biden is not putting that in the first round, which makes sense. There's only so much you can put together in the first 100 days. But mostly, I'm sorry to say, the Georgieva agenda, which we all, I think all decent economists agree on, we only get a nibble at that in this package. But that's okay. There will be more.
Yes, as you say, in this package, but that's only phase one, according to Biden and his people. And he's got green and all sorts of other plans ahead. But I want to ask you more of a political question now. Maybe it's also an economic question, but what do you see ahead for the Republican Party? And I don't just mean the Republican Party. I mean particularly those who voted with Trump to the end, voted to overturn the election and the election results on that January 6th, even after the insurrection in the Capitol. And now we see major financial institutions, major Republican donors, CEOs, corporations are threatening and are pulling the plug on that kind of undemocratic policy and politics. How do you see that playing out?
Well, I mean, God knows in terms of the future of the Republic. I have no special expertise there. In terms of the economic agenda, in a peculiar way, it almost helps, because the fact of the matter was that Barack Obama faced a Republican Party that was totally engaged in scorched earth opposition, that was not at all willing to do anything to help him help the economy. They just wanted to sabotage anything that he tried to do. But he didn't quite understand that at first. And even once he understood it, a lot of mainstream people, a lot of centrist people didn't get it. They thought that the Republicans were actually sincere when they talked about deficits and all of that. This time, with the background of the sacking of the Capitol and all of that, I think a lot more people, including, as you say, donors, financial institutions, see Biden's opposition for what it is. And that may make it, although it's scary as heck, it may mean that we have a better chance of actually getting good economic policies, because people will understand what's actually driving the opposition to those policies.
Maybe, just maybe, there might be a glimmer of a chance for some bipartisan support. We'll see. Paul Krugman, thank you so much indeed for joining me tonight. Now, President Trump is expected to issue a flurry of pardons in the hours before leaving office. He faces a storm of legal and financial issues, as well the question of what he'll do next. With his personal brand tarnished, as we said, by the violent end to his presidency, what do future business ventures look like for him? Joining me to discuss what lies ahead are Mary Trump, the president's niece and author of Too Much and Never Enough, and Andrea Bernstein, author of American Oligarchs and co-host of the hit podcast Trump Inc. Ladies, welcome to the program. So, kind of building on what we discussed just now with Paul Krugman, where does the lay of the land sort of settle for Trump and for the nation in the post-Trump era. But let me ask you first, Mary, because you've written so much about, you know, his character, his demons, some of his mental health issues, and you are yourself a clinical psychologist. I want to ask you how you interpreted and assessed, you know, what's happened over these last 2 weeks? What happened since the election and then the crisis on January 6th?
A lot of what's happened is a direct result of Donald's absolute inability to grapple with the fact that he lost the election. And everything since then has been an attempt to convince other people that the election was rigged simply because Joe Biden won. As for last week, that was the culmination of his failed attempts to overturn the election results because he's becoming increasingly desperate. He's still desperate. So, you know, this isn't over, unfortunately. And as we've seen, he's perfectly willing to incite violence against his own country because he is incapable, psychologically and emotionally incapable of admitting that he is indeed a loser.
I'm going to play a little bit of this shocking video. It came from The New Yorker by their, you know, war correspondent who happened to get inside the Capitol. And we're getting just more and more pieces of the puzzle and verbally what these people were saying, including that Trump had egged them on or he was their leader. Let's just play a little bit of this for a minute.
Stand there, you're outnumbered. There's a million of us out there. And we are listening to Trump.
So as we watch more of these pictures, because they are extraordinary, no matter how many times you see them, you can hear the crowd saying to the police, move out of the way. We're here because of, you know, Trump, your boss. And then they're claiming that there's like 1 million or 4 million people outside who are going to storm the place as well. Mary Trump, before I turn to Andrea, how does a person like Donald Trump create that kind of pathology that actually resulted in violence and, yes, death? 5 people were killed on that bunker.
Well, we're going to be grappling with this for a really long time, which is why Donald needs to be contained and made irrelevant as quickly as possible. But one thing he's quite skilled at is the politics of grievance, which he's elevated to an art form. And it's tapped in to a feeling a lot of white Americans who believe they've been left behind are feeling. Also, Donald revels in violence. He is a physical coward himself, but he's perfectly happy for other people to engage in violence on his own behalf. And I think that's another thing he's tapped into. People are frustrated. People feel like their rights are being taken away from them, which, of course, they're not. And by claiming that something else has been stolen from them, he essentially just lit a match to a piece of dynamite that's been ready to go off for a really long time and just stood back and watched it happen.
So, Andrea Bernstein, of course, all this is relevant for many, many reasons, including all the democratic and constitutional reasons that we've been talking about, but also to the Donald Trump brand. What do you think it looks like for him going ahead? Because we've listed all these institutions that have cut ties with him, his banks, his, you know, donors, his, you know, all sorts of, even his organization is being shunned, the Trump organization. What, and you've written about, you know, the American oligarchs. What does it look like, the future for his brand now that it's tarnished?
Well, it is really at a low point right now. I mean, not only do his bankers and his brokers and people who have really stood by him through a lot, through Charlottesville, through children in cages, through all kinds of policies and low points and his handling of the coronavirus, all of these sort of big bankers and brokers stood with Donald Trump. But now they are walking away. And the conundrum for Donald Trump is that his customers are not his political base. So the patrons of his private golf clubs are not the kind of people who want their photographs taken on their way into playing golf. The people who can afford that, who can afford his luxury hotels, are not the Make America Great crowd. And that is a real, real problem for Donald Trump. And, you know, one of the things that he has always done throughout his business career is find somebody, some new person who will go along with his new con, his new scam. And he has just sort of been able to hop from project to project to project with each one failing because he could always find new people to buy in to his new promised vision. Usually it's a false vision, but he was able to convince people that it would be a great deal. And they would go along because they thought it would be exciting and they would make money. And in most cases, customers, associates, lawyers, bankers would lose money and he would win. And what's different from him now, from his previous crises, is that almost everybody knows what happened last week and what has happened in his presidency. So he has a much smaller base of new potential partners to reach out to at this point in his business.
Okay, so that's really interesting because there are many people who believe, like what he said and what some of his supporters have said, he will create, a new news network or some reality television program or whatever it is. Donald Trump, they say, is a grifter and he's always, you know, got nine lives. And he hasn't, extinguished all those lives yet. I want to ask both of you whether you think that is an obvious conclusion and we should never count Donald Trump out at this point. Andrea, from your perspective, and then I'll ask Mary.
Well, from all the time I've spent studying him, I would never entirely count him out. However, from his perspective, the odds are in fact worse. And there's a story that Donald Trump's original biographer, Wayne Barrett, wrote in his book, which was called Trump, the Deals and the Downfall. It was written in 1992. And Trump's publicist tried to convince him to not say the downfall because Trump was coming back from, at that point, being $800 million in debt. And that was true. He did come back. But he has a much smaller group of people that he can convince that he is not going to cheat them. And I think that is the big problem for Donald Trump going forward is there's not a banker in the world who doesn't know what faces them. There is not a real estate broker or a lawyer or a potential business partner that doesn't understand the catastrophe that could await. Donald Trump has walked away from almost everyone close to him, and they've walked away from him. And that's the problem that he now faces. Not that he can't find a way to come back, because he frequently does, but that he faces a much bleaker world, even in the last 2 weeks. I mean, he was urged by some of his friends not to do the kind of thing he did, to gracefully concede the election for the sake of his business, and he chose not to do that.
And he has personally guaranteed, according to the tax reports that you've all seen that the New York Times talked about, $421 million of his company's debts, apparently $300 million plus coming due within 4 years. He's got tax disputes with the IRS. There's potential suits in the state of New York, etc. Mary, what do you think is A, going through the mind of this person you know, and particularly on financial issues, which is what a lot of what you wrote your book about, but also kind of, do you think he's got his back to the wall or do you think he is still Houdini?
He definitely has his back to the wall, but as Andrea said, we can't count him out ever. He is increasingly desperate and will pull out all the stops to try to reinvent himself again, which is why I think it's less important what Donald does than what the Senate and Congress, and sorry, House of Representatives do, what the banks do, and what states' attorneys generals do, because Donald needs to be sidelined. He needs to be contained. He needs to be rendered irrelevant. This also extends to his children. And I think his behavior in the last 2 months, especially the last 2 weeks, has increased the urgency of that. They need to make sure he can never run for public office again. Basically, Donald needs to be a full-time defendant going forward. He's looking at very serious lawsuits. He, as you mentioned, is looking at his banks calling in his enormous debts, and he's looking at serious state-level charges. That's what should be occupying his time.
And not only that, he's looking at a lawsuit that you filed against him, right, in September. This is part of the brief. For Donald J. Trump, his sister Marianne, and their late brother Robert, fraud was not just the family business, it was a way of life. Of course, you know, he denies all the accusations and everything you wrote in the book, we have to say that. But what is the heart of your lawsuit against him?
It's actually pretty simple, and it has nothing to do at all with my grandfather's estate. It has to do with my dad's estate. After my father died when I was 16, my Aunt Marianne and my two uncles were my fiduciaries and my trustees, and they were responsible for keeping my inheritance safe. Instead, what they did was they undervalued the value of my partnerships. So when we settled our last lawsuit in 2000, they essentially defrauded me out of tens of millions of dollars, which I did not know about until the extraordinary reporting done by Suzanne Craig and Russ Buettner in October 2018.
And that was in the New York Times. So, Andrea, you yes. also wrote that Mary's lawsuit was, quote, a handbook to everything we suspected about her uncle's business, but didn't actually know for certain. So tell me, expand on that a little bit. And I mean, I guess we've talked a little bit about what he might do in the future, but how that informs what you might be looking for in the future.
Right. Well, I mean, I think that Donald Trump's business model has always been to inflate the value of his assets when it is beneficial for him to do so, for example, when he wants to get a bank loan, and to deflate the value of those assets when he, for example, doesn't want to pay taxes. And it is the same kind of thing that Mary Trump experienced, which is that when he didn't want to share his fortune, he deflated the value of the assets. And I think what we see in Mary Trump's lawsuit and in a number of other lawsuits is that people are coming forward with receipts and specific accounts. And Donald Trump has always managed to stay one step ahead of the law. And I should add that one of the reasons and one of the ways that we sort of get to January 6th is because people kept going along with him. People kept thinking, well, I'm getting something out of this, so therefore I am not going to stand up and challenge Donald Trump. And that certainly applies to almost the entirety of the Republican Party until January 6th, people on his staff. That's how he got power, by getting these willing accomplices. And these legal reckonings, both the criminal suits that he faces and the civil lawsuits like Mary Trump's, are really an opportunity to bring out into the open what we could see the contours of, but not necessarily the specifics.
Okay, so I want to ask one last question to both of you, and it's actually about the cult of personality. But first, I want to just acknowledge that Mary has called her uncle's way of working the grift. We go all the way back to the debates in the 2016 campaign when Hillary Clinton called him out as a, quote, con man. You know, the critics were saying, you know, he's gone through his life as, you know, basically conning institutions, as you've all laid out. I want to play what Hillary Clinton said and then just quickly ask you a question afterwards.
This is just more evidence that Donald Trump himself is a fraud. He is trying to scam America the way he scammed all those people at Trump U. It's important that we recognize what he has done, because that's usually a pretty good indicator of what he will do.
So that was obviously a campaign event, and she's talking about the now discredited Trump University that did turn out to be discredited. So I want to ask you, Mary, and you, Andrea, what about all these people who stormed the Capitol? In other words, what about the most fanatic, the most extreme, the most dedicated of the people who really love him still? Where do you think they will go? And what do you think is going to happen with this cult of personality that has been created over the last 4 years? Mary.
It's an extremely important question, and unfortunately there are no easy answers or fixes. But it's really important just to say straight up that a large part of this is racism, white supremacy. And, you know, white supremacy is an infiltrated our military. It's infiltrated our local police departments because of Republican objections years ago. The panel that was meant to deal with domestic terrorists, white domestic terrorists, was dismantled. That needs to be reinstated. We need to contain this virus. It's so bad for this country. And once we do that, we need to start educating people that the biggest problem we face is racism in this country. Without that, Donald wouldn't have happened, and what happened on January 6th wouldn't have happened.
And in our last minute, Andrea, from you, particularly because most people say, and he says, I met the people who were not getting their voice heard, who were not getting their needs met.
Yes, and I think that, you know, he has sort of... it is an authoritarian technique to get people to not believe in the truth and then get them to follow you. And, you know, sort of one of the tragedies of history is that the children of Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner, their, so that is Donald Trump's grandchildren, their great-grandparents were Holocaust survivors. And I think it is a really instructive lesson of history. They have an incredible tale of survival, Jared Kushner's grandparents. And what happened after World War II is instructive, which is that people didn't become de-radicalized overnight. There had to be a long historical commitment to both a sense of collective and a sense of truth. So this does not end on January 20th. This is the beginning of a process where there can be a restoration of a sense of common humanity. We've done it before in history, but it is very, very hard, and I think people should be prepared for that.
Indeed, the work is still ahead. Andrea Bernstein and Mary Trump, thank you both very much for joining us. Now, since that insurrection at the Capitol nearly 2 weeks ago, people are still shocked that it could have happened, both politically and operationally. Jay Johnson is the former Secretary of Homeland Security. He blames, of course, security failures, not to mention the Pentagon dithering over deploying the National Guard for several hours while pro-Trump fanatics took control inside.
Defend your Constitution! Defend your liberty! Yes. Defend your Constitution! Defend your liberty!
And as Obama's Secretary of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson had to oversee Trump's inauguration 4 years ago. Here he is talking to our Walter Isaacson about the state of national security this time around.
Thank you, Christian and Jay Johnson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Walter.
Today is Martin Luther King Day, and we're still trying to process what happened back on January 6th. To what extent do you think it was unleashing a sentiment that's been hidden in our country and that the current president, the outgoing president, helped unleash?
Walter, you're correct. Today is Martin Luther King Day. I'm a graduate of Morehouse College, class of 1979. Dr. King was a graduate of Morehouse College in 1948. Over my right shoulder, you'll see a black and white photograph of Dr. Benjamin E. Mays, president emeritus of Morehouse College, who was a mentor to both me and Dr. King. He actually gave the eulogy at Dr. King's funeral in 1968. Dr. King talked about the single garment of destiny and the inescapable network of mutuality that we find ourselves in. We have to face the harsh reality that in America, there is a strand that is ugly, that is intolerant, that is racist, that is prone to violence if provoked, if stoked, and is vulnerable to fake news, conspiracy theories, appeals to overt racism. Over the last 4 years, frankly, this outgoing president has peeled the lid off that strand of our society, told them they're special people, that he loves them, and encouraged them to come out and display their bigotry and their intolerance in the open. We saw that in Charlottesville in 2017, and we saw it the other Wednesday on the steps and inside the U.S. Capitol. The images are unforgettable. To me, the most horrifying image was of someone parading a Confederate flag through the halls of the U.S. Capitol. We fought an entire civil war to prevent that from happening. Walter, I have ancestors from Virginia who fled slavery, as one in particular, as a teenager, to join a colored infantry of the Union Army to prevent something like that happening. And so this ought to shake Americans to the core to see what happened at the Capitol the other day. A lot of us would like to believe it can't happen here. We're the most sophisticated democracy in the world, but it can happen here if the wrong forces are encouraged and emboldened.
How guilty do you think the outgoing president is of intentionally inciting that sentiment in our society?
I think that's exactly what he did, intentionally exciting and inciting that segment of our society. If he didn't know what he was doing, he certainly had a depraved indifference to what he was doing. Word is inside the White House that he was actually excited by what was happening in the U.S. Capitol at the time. Those are the exact wrong instincts to have in a president of the United States. But I believe that he is guilty of inciting a riot. I believe he is guilty of an impeachable offense and should be convicted for it. In the Senate, that is.
Do you think that that would further divide the nation?
Well, as you're a historian, you probably know that Alexander Hamilton said at the time of the writing of the Constitution that the impeachment process stirs the passions of the community. It is a difficult thing to have to bring the nation through. But something like this, we just cannot let go. A sitting president inciting a mob to storm the U.S. Capitol and to interrupt a constitutional proceeding involving the House of Representatives, the Senate, and his own vice president, that cannot be forgiven. We cannot walk away from it because we're afraid it will be too contentious, too difficult. I'm afraid we're going to have to face this at some point. The Senate's going to have a trial of what happened here.
Do you think the Department of Homeland Security failed us in the walk up to January 6th?
I believe that those responsible for the security of the U.S. Capitol, those responsible for assessing the threat picture, failed us, yes. And this could have been avoided. We saw what was coming. It wasn't classified intelligence. It was out in the open. All you had to do was watch for it on social media and anticipate what President Trump was going to say on that day. This would not have been hard. One of the problems I suspect we had on January 6th, where we literally saw an insurrection, the very definition of an insurrection. You had an acting Secretary of Homeland Security, you had an acting Attorney General, and you had an acting Secretary of Defense, all eyeing the exits, days away from leaving office, worrying whether or not they're going to get fired. And somebody very clearly took their eye off the ball for this very important event.
Assess for us the inside threats that may have occurred in this January 6th insurrection. I mean, we hear that some of the police officers inside, maybe even members of Congress, were aiding and abetting this insurrection.
Insider threats are always the thing we worry about most in any major security event. Let's not forget that before anyone can become a member of the National Guard or the Capitol Police, or especially the Secret Service, there's a great level of vetting, screening, background scrutiny that goes into selecting those people and training those people. There probably is appropriate now another additional level of screening before anyone is specifically selected for the event. But by and large, the people we have as gun carriers for a major security event like this are people who've already been carefully screened and vetted.
As Secretary of Homeland Security, you were able to monitor and watch the rise of these extremist groups and, you know, racist groups that came up. How do you think it's best that we try to handle those and prevent the rise of groups like that?
Walter, it's been an evolution. After 9/11, the Department of Homeland Security was created principally for counterterrorism. And the view then was that terrorism was an extraterritorial threat. And if you consolidate into one cabinet level department regulation of all the different ways one can enter the country, land, sea, and air, you've effectively dealt with terrorism. Over the last 19 and a half years now, since 9/11, we know that the principal terrorist threat is here among us, domestic-based, domestic-inspired extremism. The Anti-Defamation League, for example, has tracked this for years now. And so most acts of terrorism come from within. I'm afraid that the old model, the DHS model after 9/11, is now badly outdated. So in my time in office, we spent a lot of time here in the homeland on what we refer to as CVE, countering violent extremism, meeting with groups in major metropolitan areas. And in my last year in office, I'm pleased that Congress actually gave us grant money to distribute to organizations dedicated to countering violent extremism here at home, including violent white nationalism. There's an organization, Chicago-based, at least there was 4 years ago, called Life After Hate, that we wanted to fund. Unfortunately, those efforts kind of went off the rails over the last 4 years. I hope that there is a rededication to that. And then, of course, there's always the law enforcement aspect to this. Our FBI, our Homeland Security officials need to rededicate themselves to tracking and interdicting and prosecuting those who turn violent before they can actually carry out their acts of violence.
You just said that your old Department of Homeland Security is not constituted, not set up right to counter the domestic extremism that we're facing. How would you change it?
Well, look, if I had a magic wand, you know, time out of office gives one some perspective. If I had a magic wand and I could just reconstitute our federal government, our executive branch, through decree, I'd probably create a Department of Public Safety, which exists in many other governments around the world, in which we have every federal law enforcement agency, including Homeland Security Investigations, the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, the Marshals Service, deconflict all of their missions under one cabinet level official, put the Department of Justice off to the side, those are the lawyers. It'll probably never happen, but that is the ideal way to deal with our domestic security, our law enforcement needs, in my judgment. It would be a huge department, but what we have set up right now is you have many law enforcement agencies as part of DOJ and many as part of DHS that oftentimes don't deconflict well. The actual largest collection of law enforcement agents is in DHS, not DOJ, but there's still the FBI, the ATF, the DEA, the Marshals Service that reside within DOJ. And occasionally, frankly, they compete with one another. And occasionally, depending upon the leadership, they don't communicate well. In the current threat environment, I think there needs to be greater efforts at consolidation.
Do you think that the incoming Secret Service details that will guard President Biden and Vice President Harris have to be changed and have to be particularly scrutinized as you move over from the details that were guarding President Trump?
Well, I don't want to get into too much, too many matters of operational security. The presidential detail itself is huge. And there is a detail leader with overall responsibility for protecting the president, the vice president, certain other people in the White House. And there is a fair amount of turnover that goes into that. It's an extraordinarily demanding job. Someone should not be in it for a very long period of time. On the other hand, you want somebody who is familiar with the protectees' movements, their moods, their reactions to things so they can anticipate their behavior and their movements. And so there is a certain amount of turnover that naturally goes into the Secret Service anytime there are our new round of protectees.
Your great-grandfather was born enslaved in Virginia, and his son became a famous sociologist. His great-grandson became a cabinet secretary. Tell me how your family history informs the way you think about this current moment.
My grandfather was a sociologist. He had a PhD. He wrote a lot about civil rights in the 1940s and 1950s. He was suspected of being a member of the Communist Party. My own grandfather testified before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1949 in the same room, I'm told, in a House office building where I testified in oversight hearings for the Department of Homeland Security. But he was an optimist. He believed in this country. He believed in the code of the nation. He died in 1956. An optimist even before we had civil rights laws. So I don't believe he would be surprised that his own grandson would ultimately become responsible for the homeland security of the nation. I do think he would be very disappointed, as am I, that 12 years after we elected a Black president, which for many of us was a huge step forward toward a more perfect union, we still live with a very large strand of American society that is racist, intolerant, prone to violence, grievance, disenfranchised. And once in a while, the lid gets peeled off and that kind of hatred comes out in the open. We still live with this. We live with it in the 40s and 50s. We live with it in the 60s, and it's still here well into the 21st century. And I'm afraid that we may continue to live with it for my lifetime and yours. And it's really up to the mainstream of America to turn their back on this kind of hatred and condemn it and deplore it.
This past weekend, you were the guest host of a Newark radio station show, and you got to do a playlist in which you pick some songs of protest, peace, and prayer.
And prayer, right.
And one of them, the final one, which really moved me, is one of my favorite songs, was sung by somebody from here in New Orleans. It was Mahalia Jackson's How I Got Over. And yep. She sang that during Martin Luther King's March on Washington in 1963. Tell me why you picked that.
Well, you've really done your homework for this interview. Well, thank you. That's my other life. I'm a huge classic R&B fan, and there's a small little public radio station here in the northern New Jersey area, WBGO 88.3. Yes, I'm giving a plug for it. And every once in a while, I go on the station, and I literally select my own music, spin my own records. And so I thought it was appropriate to play songs that reflect prayer, peace, and protest. And Mahalia was the voice of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. And you're right, How I Got Over was one of the songs she sang at the March on Washington. There are many accounts that she stole the show that day. And I thought it was a suitable tribute to Martin Luther King. This is MLK weekend. And I thought it was a gesture at trying to heal our nation right now, at least for the listeners of that small little station, which can be heard all over the tri-state New York area, by the way.
Tell me what she said to Dr. King when he was reading his prepared speech.
Well, you know, that's interesting. As the story goes, he was reading from a prepared text when he was giving his speech at the March on Washington. And it's apparent, when you watch the speech, he's reading from a prepared text. And as the story goes, Mahalia, who was sitting within earshot of him, said, "Tell him about the dream, Martin." And he had actually given a version of I Have a Dream at a march in Detroit some months before. And so he kind of leaned back, looked up, and began to talk about how he had a dream. And, you know, the rest is history, as you know. But as the story goes, that whole part of the speech was inspired by Mahalia Jackson and prompted by Mahalia Jackson.
Your angels kept watching over me.
Right.
Secretary Jay Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on. This is a great discussion.
And that was such a great story about Mahalia Jackson and MLK. And of course, finally tonight, it is Martin Luther King Day today. But this year, it is against the backdrop of violent white supremacy, Black Lives Matter, and also, though, with a chance this week to turn that page on the national conversation. We want to recall Dr. King's persistent adherence to nonviolent protest, despite the violence that was directed at him and his community, and also his cool, calm, collected, and yes, very wise response to the FBI's dogged attempts to destroy him and his movement by making him out to be a communist. Look at what he said in this clip from the new documentary, MLK FBI.
I would hope that the FBI would come out and say something that I think is much more significant, and that is that it is amazing that so few Negroes have turned to communism in the light of that desperate plight. I think it is one of the amazing developments of the 20th century, how loyal the Negro has remained to America in spite of his long night of oppression and discrimination.
Fair point. And perhaps also a note to those who today would insist on portraying legitimate constitutional protest and the pursuit of equality for all as communism or radical socialism. Let's also just reflect on Martin Luther King's incredible dignity and his brilliance as such a young leader. He was only 34 years old when he delivered his I Have a Dream speech, and he wasn't even 40 when he was martyred. Such an inspiration his life was for all the young, and of course, the not so young. That is it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.